You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside. We're just a quick hop, skip, and a jump from Senor Tadpoles.
Spring break.
By the way, it was recently announced that Judy Greer will be in Jurassic World. Somehow I don't think her spring break move is going to protect her from raptors in that. Joining me today via Skype from Austin, Texas, Daniel T. Richards.
It's below 60 degrees here and everyone is miserable.
That sounds like California. It hits about 65, 70 and people think it's winter.
Seriously, I'm wearing a sweater.
Also with us is a man known for his pop culture commentary and his long-dead singing career, Mario Lanza.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to be here. I used to listen to this show all the time when I was a kid, and I'm so excited to be here.
Well, that's only possible because the Doctor would time travel back and distribute our episodes in the past. So
yeah,
here you go.
I didn't want to brag, but yeah, I mean, that's really what happened.
Do you have anything you want to plug, Mario, while you're here?
I'm not sure how familiar people are with my stuff. If you like Survivor, I've written more about Survivor than pretty much anybody in the world. Go to the website, funny115.com. That's my website with most of my Survivor writing. So that is how you can check me out.
Yes, that website is very good, and it's very funny, as you would think from the title. And the other thing I would say is to check out his Historians podcast if you like him on this podcast here. Mario, I find to be wildly entertaining, especially off the cuff, which is why we brought him on here.
So, Mario, do you cover all of Destiny Child's songs or just that one?
Just that one. It's really, for 12 years, I've focused on the one song.
It's deep. I understand. So yeah, I'm just curious.
If anything, I'm OCD. That's really kind of how the best would describe me.
Right. I mean, you got 115 funny things out of that one song.
It's fucking amazing. It's the greatest song ever. It's like Stairway to Heaven, if you think about it.
Well, other things that are amazing, Dan will tell us now how raptors aren't the only predator that Judy Greer is going to have to learn how to deal with.
Woo! It's spring break time for old horny men.
Spring break.
That's right. The New York Post is reporting that when a time when all these young, scantily clad, bikini-laden women are filling beaches across the southern United States, so are horny old men looking to shack up with college girls and relive their college days. It's all about the spring break mentality, according to 31-year-old Justin, who lives in Midtown and has asked that his last name not be used for professional reasons. It's easier to get laid, he clarifies.
Well, I just want to clarify, I don't live in Midtown.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Irvine.
That's exactly what someone would say who was being interviewed for this article.
But I don't have a job, so what professional... No, I do. I tutor. But I guess maybe that's why I would need to protect, because I tutor?
Exactly. That's exactly what someone interviewed for this article would say. He continues so eloquently, I could run around New York City and bang as many girls as I do on spring break, but it's not the same feeling. You're out in the sun, the all-inclusive thing is great, it's always a great time. I never come back wondering why I did that.
I think there are just greater issues going on with this guy. I mean, forget the phenomenon of this idea that there are horny old men, and by the way, 31 years old is old.
20, right, they say 28 to 31 year olds.
Wow. It's like golden
horny
girls.
Old men.
Exactly, golden girls, yeah. I mean, I guess when Justin Bieber is getting famous at like 13, that's why 31's old. But, I mean, forget that phenomenon. There's going to be something wrong with this guy that, you know, he doesn't wonder what's wrong with him when he's doing the messed up thing. And when he's actually running around New York City doing a messed up thing but not as bad messed up, he wonders what's wrong with him.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the main, the quote, principle of this story is that these people have a lot of money now. And when they have a lot of money, then they want to go back and relive the things that they were doing in college where they had no money. That seems to be the common theme here.
But isn't the reason people only do that stuff in college because they have no money?
I don't know. I never did this.
Well, it does seem like cause and effect, yes.
Right. I mean, I never did it either, but it seemed like the only reason people drank PBR wasn't because they were hipsters. It was because PBRs were a dollar.
You mean PBR isn't good? Is that what you're saying?
I have no idea. I've never...
There goes the other sponsor.
Exactly. I lost your sponsor dollar right there.
You're terrible at this, Justin. God, I wonder if we lose so much money on this podcast. A New York City-based jet setter and lady chaser, another guy named Justin, who's 30, explains, real men don't shoot fish in a barrel, they use their lure.
Double entendre much?
Man, it must be a group of poets they're sending down from New York City.
If you're aiming for something the size of a barrel, you're picking the wrong women.
Zing.
Yeah, I remember that part from the article, and he actually, you know, he made a good point. He has some level of, like, maturity to him. Like, if you're just going down there and you're throwing your money around and you're sleeping with 19-year-olds, then what feeling are you getting out of that? That seems to demonstrate, as I said about the first Justin, some inadequacy on his own part.
It's at least a certain feeling of friction.
For a little bit.
For a little bit.
Not if it's a barrel.
Yeah, that's true.
But another spring break news, spring break may no longer exist after climate change. That's why the National Science Foundation has funded a climate change musical for a scant $700,000.
Did they kickstart this?
No, well, they kicked you in the nuts and took your tax money and then started this musical. That's probably not what you're referring to.
No, that's not what I was referring to, but so the basic issue here is that this is tax money.
Yeah, the basic issue is that it's tax money, and the representatives interviewed in this article said, basically, fund research, fine, but why are you funding a musical through the National Science Foundation? The description of the musical is a thrilling and timely production that is a highly technical look into one of the most vital questions of our time. How can we change ourselves and our society to solve the enormous environmental challenges that confront us? The play is called The Great Immensity. And it focuses on a woman named Phyllis as she tries to track down a friend who disappeared while filming an assignment for a nature show on a tropical island.
Is this like some weird quasi-sequel to The Office starring the woman who played Phyllis?
Is she the old one?
Yeah, with the glasses, who was like the awkward old lady who you really liked but was kind of stupid.
Yeah, she was like 31. She was old.
Ancient. Well, with a name like Phyllis.
Well, right, you could see how she would easily get hoodwinked into this. And that's why I made that joke is, the way they're figuring out how to solve it is the way everyone solves things on Broadway. They just sing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the icebergs will melt tomorrow and things like that.
I was just thinking if you wanted like a thing of based on reality of what's happening in the world, what you want is a show where people just randomly sing about it.
Yeah.
Well, if you learned anything from Glee, that's what I learned.
Yes.
I learned that if I have any feelings of being uncomfortable around gay people, that I'm weird and that I should sing all the time. That's what I learned from Glee.
I think those are the two main takeaways. So I don't know. The name, The Great Immensity, is interesting to me. The Great Immensity. That sounds like something out of our spring break story.
It sounds like from The Fifth Element. What was the thing that was coming to take over? It was just that giant black thing, or it sounds like the Neverending Story, the nothing from the Neverending Story.
I think both of those things are racist, but let's move on.
Yeah, you people, come on.
I think we'll just move on from that. We won't acknowledge Justin.
MoveOn.org.
Yeah. We're going to move on to our friends over at TalkBacker, who are reporting that Will Wheaton is going to host his own Talk Soup for Geeks on the Syfy Network. That's actually sci-fi, but they took out the I's and put in Y's, so to me it's Syfy from
right,
now on.
Right, so they made it a STD. As if
exactly.
People didn't hate the sci-fi network enough.
Exactly. TalkBacker reports, Will Wheaton announced that he'll be hosting the Will Wheaton Project, a weekly talk show that he describes as Talk Super Geeks. Will Wheaton goes on to explain that the project is a weekly roundup of things I love on television and on the internet, with commentary and jokes, and the occasional visit from interesting people who make those things happen.
I feel like this is a bad impersonation of Chris Hardwick or Joel McHale. Because, you know, Talk Soup and then the whole Nerdist podcast that Chris Hardwick has. I mean, look, I follow Will Wheaton on Twitter, and if it's what he finds interesting, it's pictures of his dog with the same caption over and over again. I swear to God, like five times a day he tweets pictures of a dog and it says, I'm a dog. Or then it also says, can I have human food? Or you have steak. I want steak. And I'm like, why do you tweet these things?
Yeah, what's funny is Gordy LaChance grew up to be a terrible writer. It's the Stand By Me irony.
Yeah. It is funny that you say, you bring up the Joel McHale, Chris Hardwick thing, Justin, because I think Will Wheaton does look like the devolved Pokemon version of both Joel McHale and Chris Hardwick.
That's what he is. It's not that he looks like it. He is that. I mean.
Yeah. What? I don't understand why he's a celebrity.
Well, right. Does anyone else? This article has spawned a lot of comments on TalkBacker because it's kind of a hot button issue. This is whole, the whole, you know, people don't like the Big Bang Theory because they call it nerd blackface. And they say that.
What?
You've never heard this term before, nerd blackface?
I'm going to use it now all the time.
It's the idea that Hollywood is taking nerd culture and trying to market it, but it's not really representative of nerds.
Okay.
And, you know, this is kind of in the same vein as that where people are complaining. So it spawned a lot of comments on TalkBacker. And I think the best one was by user Uncle Mommy, and that, which is a weird name in itself. But and it really echoes what you just said, Dan. He says, Will Wheaton has somehow made a career out of being Will Wheaton. I'm not entirely sure how that is possible.
Exactly. I watched Star Trek The Next Generation. He was an interesting character who was a bit annoying. And then he became a celebrity, and I don't know how that works.
Well, I actually have a serious answer for that. I know where that Will Wheaton as Will Wheaton kind of started.
Okay.
That was in the VH1, I Love the 80s, I Love the 90s. He was one of the absolute funniest commentators on there, and just because Will Wheaton was this huge nerd. And I think that probably started it for him, because all of a sudden people just knew him as this nerd as opposed to an actor, so he kind of became himself.
Right, so I guess the serious answer, if we're going to turn off our mockery here for a second, what Mario's talking about is in the, you know, when they started doing that stuff on VH1 was around the time that nerd culture started to become marketable, right? That's when the studios started to really do the superhero movies. Like, that's around the time X-Men 1 came out, right?
Yeah, it's all the superhero blackface started happening.
Only superheroes should be allowed to play superheroes. That's what I'm saying.
Because Ryan Reynolds can actually fly, so that works out real well.
Why was the Green Lantern like the worst movie then?
Pretty fly for anyway.
So that was around the time that, you know, they started making those. And then what Hollywood does is they always find the people who are already in their community rather than introduce new people. The introduction of the new people come later. So you look at someone like Will Wheaton, who, you know, as we said, was in Stand By Me and TNG and then kind of disappeared. And then even Chris Hardwick was known for Singled Out with Jenny McCarthy. Remember that game show?
Yep.
So these are kind of people who were within the industry that they took and recycled them, basically.
Yep.
Is it bad that I only know of that show because of reruns of the old Loveline?
No, because those were like MTV's two big, young, hip romance shows at that time.
Mm. Well, in another egregious example of geek blackface, HBO's Silicon Valley premiere has bombed, according to Elon Musk, who is not happy because it doesn't accurately portray the life of Silicon Valley employees.
It doesn't accurately portray it, but it only has three of the funniest people in Hollywood in it, so, you know, it's a total bomb.
Elon Musk is not very happy. He says, quote, none of those characters were software engineers. Software engineers are more helpful, thoughtful, and smarter. They're weird, but not in that way, he insisted. I was just having a meeting with my information security team, and they're great, but they're pretty fucking weird. One used to be a dude, one's super small, one's hyper smart. That's actually what it is.
All I know is it sounds like Elon Musk should start pitching TV shows, because I want to watch a show about someone who used to be a dude, one's small, and one's really weird. That sounds like a great premise to me.
Yeah. You know, I am a software engineer in real life. I have lived in Silicon Valley. I went to school there. They are pretty weird. They are odd people.
Yeah, he criticizes the writers for never having been to Burning Man, which he says is Silicon Valley.
Is that true, Mario?
I've never had any interest in going there, so I'm guessing not for everybody.
Well, right. So, and, you know, I appreciate Elon Musk. He's done a lot of great things. He has a lot of great ideas. He was in Iron Man 2, so, you know, I admire him for that. But this is another example of somebody taking their own identity and applying it to a show and applying it to the definition of something and thinking that's the one definition. I feel like Elon Musk is looking at his own point of view, what he knows about Silicon Valley and the people he works with, and saying that's what they should represent 100%. Where there's two things going on. One, there's much more outside of his perspective that represents Silicon Valley. And two, they're making a TV show to make a certain point, which may not represent his point of view 100%.
I should mention that the show is created by Mike Judge of Beavis and Butthead fame, of course.
Beavis and Butthead, hey. King of the Hill, Extract with Jason Bateman and Mila Kunis.
Well, Office Space too, right? Yeah, yeah, and Office Space is as close to Silicon Valley software engineers as I've ever seen.
Right.
Yeah, when did we become so enthralled with seeing basically an exact representation of reality on TV or movies? Isn't it the reason we go to see TV or movies to see a heightened sense of reality or a heightened sense of what really, I mean, I don't want to go and watch my neighbor Steve on TV. That would be really boring. He also smokes a lot.
Is he the one upstairs who says the absurd things?
No, I still don't know those people's names. The communists upstairs.
I want to see a show about them.
They are a caricature of themselves. So.
No, I mean, this is part of the whole thing where people aren't watching it to be entertained. They're watching it to be affirmed. And it's about seeing a reflection of yourself in reality rather than actually going out and creating that reflection. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense why people would want that. I think it's dumb.
Well, I agree it's dumb as well, and it makes for poor entertainment, but I think that's ultimately where it comes from. I mean, I look at the show. I see this. I mean, I'm not a software engineer or anything, so maybe Mario can speak to if this connects with him or not. But I look at the show, and I don't see any connection with myself. I just see funny creator Mike Judge, and then I see TJ Miller, who's fucking hilarious. I don't know if anyone's ever seen the stuff he's been in, but he's really funny. Then Kumail Nanjiani, who's also hilarious and up and coming. I wouldn't surprise to see him blow up thanks to this show. And I don't mean that because he is brown-skinned. That's not a racist comment. And Martin Starr, who everybody knows, you know, Freaks and Geeks, Party Down. He's one of the funniest guys in the world. So I see those three people in a show together. I don't care what the content is. They could be elephant poop scoopers at the zoo and I'd watch it.
What's particularly funny is when you say this theory that people want to watch themselves on TV is that from what I know of software engineers, they don't tend to watch a lot of TV. They do a lot of other stuff. So it's kind of interesting that you have a show about software engineers expecting software engineers to watch it.
Well, right. I mean, maybe that was their own fault for inviting Elon Musk to the premiere, because what has he ever commented on any sort of pop culture movie thing? Like, I know he was in Iron Man 2, but he didn't even say anything about it when he was, did he?
Not that I know of. He's pretty quiet.
Right. He was just like,
so tall.
Right. So he was just like, cool, I'm in Iron Man 2. But he didn't, like, say a word about it either way. And this time, I guess maybe because they were trying to elicit their sympathies or something? I don't know.
Well, one person who sees himself on TV a lot, but not recently, is President Barack Obama. Because the network snubbed Obama on primetime healthcare address, according to BuzzFeed, the most reliable source of political news in existence today.
Are they a reliable source of any news besides which Firefly character are you?
I think that's important that we know exactly the kind of House of Cards tactics you would use if you were dating. So,
I would just push them into train tracks.
Oh, God. White House officials sought valuable primetime air for a rare impromptu Tuesday night address to tout the accomplishment of signing up more than 7 million people under the Affordable Care Act. But network officials refused to make the kind of accommodation they did previously for the announcement that Osama bin Laden had been killed, for instance. And Obama was left instead cutting into the much smaller audiences of Ellen.
So many jokes.
Is that a dig? Is that a dig on Ellen?
It is a dig on Ellen. And I was actually... trying to, the reason I didn't respond right away is I was trying to kind of gauging how offended I was. Because recently we discussed how my respect for, and I think all of our respect for Ellen continues to grow. And I think this makes me like Ellen even more.
Now why is that? Why does this make you like Ellen more?
because it's just kind of like she continues to prove that she is worthwhile and funny, and now somebody's just dismissing her as if she's not worthwhile and funny.
It's funny because they only mention Ellen. If they had mentioned Ellen and then other daytime shows, it would, you know, but just Ellen.
Right, so they're marginalizing her and making her the most important at the same time.
Right. Indeed. I think this is just a terrible slight on her and her people.
Maybe they forgot her and they have to go find her.
Was the Ellen audience mad that precious moments of the Ellen show were cut out?
I think most of them were okay, but...
That's a lot of angry middle-aged women.
Isn't the Ellen audience more of Obama's target audience for the Health Care Act anyway?
Yeah, that's the thing. My wife watches that show every day, so I know Ellen's show inside and out. But yeah, that's the exact market for who would love that Obama coming on to brag about that he pulled this off.
Right, yeah. And because they're all home all day, not working, so they don't have health care.
Exactly, it's perfect.
Yeah.
But I just think it's funny that Obama has this policy that anytime he wants to, like, say something that's important, he gets on primetime TV. You know, he doesn't, like, think he's the president and, like, oh, I'll just give a speech on the weekend and everyone will pay attention because I'm the president of the United States. He's just like, oh, well, I'm going to make sure I'm on instead of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, you know, that's nerd blackface right there.
Oh, my God.
Wait, what's nerd blackface? Obama?
The implications of that statement are so meta-racist.
Wasn't that wonderful? No, I'm just saying. He's got
so many layers.
The nerdy belief that of how a president works. And he's black.
So many layers. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is nerd yellow face, though. They just decided they were going to put as many Asians as possible on that show.
Now, that's racist. How dare you make this racist?
We were having a perfectly clean show here. Justin, exactly. And then all of a sudden, this side of you comes out that everyone doesn't like.
You had to drag it down after my perfectly good Obama joke.
And the other thing about his policy is not only does he have this policy, he does it so much that networks are sick of him. this time they're like, nah, we don't think so. Is he kind of like the boy who cried healthcare?
Yes.
Yeah, he's cried a lot of things. But calling him the boy, Justin, really? I just can't believe you today.
I'd like to apologize to my parents listening to this podcast.
I just can't. It's.
I'd like to thank my parents if they're listening to this podcast.
I'd like to thank my parents if they know what a podcast is. But
all
anyway.
All right. Well, we still don't know the end of Obama's How I Gave You Healthcare. How I Met Your Mother finally reached its not so epic conclusion this past week. We talk about that and more in the weekly discussion. The internet went nuts again this week. This time it was over How I Met Your Mother, and it was mainly on Twitter. How I Met Your Mother had its 1 hour finale this week, and in it, spoiler alert,
there's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
They killed off the mother and then had Ted end up with Robin, the girl he met in the first episode. The internet was understandably upset about this because the show was called How I Met Your Mother, not How I Ended Up Banging Robin Anyway. This is the reaction to this I have not seen since the Lost finale, where everyone felt conned when it, again, spoiler alert.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
I should just say spoiler alert for the whole segment.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
It makes me glad that I didn't watch How I Met Your Mother for the last two seasons. I gave up at the end of season 7. But I think, Mario, that you actually stayed the course and watched the whole show, right?
I was there until the bitter end. I saw every episode.
Emphasis on bitter.
Yeah. What a piece of crap that finale was. That was horrible. And they might as well rename the show How I Met Your Mother's Rival, or How I Met Your Mother's Replacement.
Yeah. That's why I said, you know, How I Banged Robin Eventually Anyway, right?
Exactly. Like, that's what it was.
It was literally to the point, right, that over the show... And, you know, we'll just talk a little bit about this, and then I want to go into a little bit more about the whole finale thing in general, the finale phenomenon. But it was literally to the point in the show that I got sick of Robin about season 4, I think, because it would keep being, Ted would keep going back to her, and she would be like, yeah, but I really only think about myself. And we were supposed to be okay with it because of her career. And, you know, I liked the idea that, you know, she was the one person in that show that seemed to be ambitious, you know, because Barney worked for, like, an evil bank that they never explained, and then Marshall was like an environmental lawyer or something, but he never did anything. And then Lily was like some sort of teacher or other. So I liked that Robin was the only one with initiative, but still Ted kept going back to her. She kept treating him like crap because she only thought about herself. And then we were supposed to keep wanting him to go back to her.
Just because she's a major character for the most part.
Right. And I mean, that's an issue with sitcom writing in general. This whole idea of, and I think this started with Moonlighting with Bruce Willis and Sybil Shepherd, where you have this tension between these two characters that culminates at the end or whatever. Is that the,
right. They have to end up together. That's the, it's just a plot convenience kind of story.
Right. And they do this on a lot of shows now. I mean, they did it on Scrubs, right? And people got sick of it there. Now they're doing it on How I Met Your Mother, Friends. So the question is about, you know, this plot contrivance in general and finales in general is, why do people have such a hard time ending shows? And is it possible to end a show and not have everyone be disappointed?
To answer the first part of that, just, I've been thinking about this all week. Why is it hard to end shows? The reason why I think it's so hard to end shows is because I don't think the writers and the producers end it exactly when they wanted to end it. I think in this case, maybe the network dragged it out. They wanted it a couple more seasons than the producers might have been expecting. And so I think a lot of the times it's not really on their terms. The network really decides how long the show's going to go more than they are.
I think that's a very astute point. A lot of times when I watch British shows, for instance, and they have 7 seasons, but 4 episodes, the ending is very good. It's tied up nicely. Everything fits. It sort of makes a lot of sense. And I don't feel like I was cheated in any way, but it's because they're not stretching over an additional 3 or 4 years to create content that they have to wrap up in a bizarre way.
Right, and I definitely think we saw that with How I Met Your Mother, where the network kept it on for 9 seasons, where I don't know why 9, but because of that, the last 2 seasons, like the first season, or season 8 was about getting to the wedding? Season 8 was about the wedding, and then season 9 was about getting to the wedding, right?
Something like that. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like the last 2 seasons were completely obsolete by the time the finale started.
Right.
They just completely canceled them out.
Right, and the season 9 was about getting to Barney and Robin's wedding, and then like halfway through the final episode, they got divorced, right?
Yeah, the entire season was the build up to their wedding, and then yeah, in the finale, halfway through, it's like, oh yeah, never mind the season, now we're gonna move on. They're gone, they divorced.
Well right, and that's just awful writing. It's a basic principle is you don't spend 90% of screen time showing something and then eliminate it in 30 seconds or half an hour. I mean, that's just really bad writing. So, I understand, like, I have sympathy for what you're saying, Mario, but it seems to me that you would take more time to figure out how to do it right, using your knowledge of writing and the basic principles of writing, than just saying, oh, well, they're screwing us over by making us draw this out, so we're just going to do it this way.
Yeah. What I think happened in this case in particular, that the writers had an ending they wanted from the very beginning, and they've said that in interviews. They knew this was the ending since day one. And as the show went along, season after season after season, and they started introducing new characters, it kind of moved away from the story they wanted to tell. Like, the mother turned out to be quite adorable. People liked her. People, the audience liked her. They really liked Ted with the mother. And so it got to the point.
Wait. So you're telling me the character that people waited 9 seasons or 8 seasons to be introduced, they ended up liking her because they weren't predisposed to liking her or anything, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Well said. But yeah, I think they kind of wrote themselves into a corner that the ending the show they started writing did not match the ending they started up with from day one, and they wanted to be real stubborn and go back to that. Well, that's what I think happened.
No, and I think that's probably 100% correct. So I think it's greater than what you're saying about this, the whole network forces them to stretch things out.
Yeah.
Because what you just noted of them trying to go back to an ending that they wrote past, I think that that's true of 2 shows that ended on their own terms and ended when they wanted to end. You know, Lost famously negotiated the deal to have only 6 seasons. Now, maybe you could argue they only wanted 5 and they did the 6 to acquiesce to the network and kind of come to a, you know, a mediation, an agreement. And so the 6th season felt largely useless, so it was. And then Battlestar Galactica also only ran 5 seasons. But both of those had endings that directly contradicted their series. So when you look at Lost, when it ended, the whole thing was about how everything wasn't like mystical and everything wasn't magic and faith, but then ultimately it ended in a church. And then Battlestar Galactica was all about mediating humanity and technology. You know, the Cylons were skin jobs, right? So they were part human, part technology. So they didn't know how much humanity do we give them? Do we treat them just like machines? And, you know, the main character, General Adama, hated even having his ship networked. So there was this whole thing about Adama gradually learning how to accept technology. And then at the end, his son just goes, oh, let's just drive all the technology into the sun and we'll live like tribes on Earth. So I feel like they had these endings, like you said, with How I Met Your Mother, pre-written. But mm-hmm. as they were taking the steps along the way, they didn't think about how they were building towards that. And to me, that's an issue of writing skill and writing ability.
No, I agree with that. I think it, to me, it's just being stubborn more than anything. I mean, writing skill and ability, they proved it lots of times during the series. They were great writers, but I just think they got stubborn at the end. They just, damn it, we have this ending we love and we're going to use it. That's what I think.
So, just to clarify for someone who has never seen a single episode of this show, did you meet the mother?
Yeah, we met her, then they killed her.
And well, I don't see what you're complaining about. You met the mother.
Not only did they kill her, there was almost no footage of her getting sick and dying. They're like, oh yeah, then she got sick and died, and then they just moved on. Like, you didn't even get a sad farewell to her dying. It was the weirdest thing.
Mm. Right.
Well, you met her.
So the show, the framing device of the show, just like, you know, the framing device of Lost is they're all lost on an island that has crazy stuff going on. Is it science or is it magic? And the framing device of Battlestar is, you know, there's a fight between robots who are somewhat human and people who don't really like robots because they're threatened. So I guess Battlestar Galactica is basically Transformers. The framing device of How I Met Your Mother was the main character is telling his kids about how he met their mother.
Right. Isn't the main character Bob Saget?
They never explained that either, right?
Yeah, they never did. All of a sudden, yeah, it was Josh Radnor and he was voiced over by Bob Saget, and at the end, they go right back to Josh Radnor speaking to his kids. So you never see Bob Saget or anything. That's funny.
Right, it was like a weird throwback to the Wonder Years that they never explained or anything.
Not even like an Arrested Development Ron Howard sort of guest appearance on the show.
No, and everyone thought that would probably happen in the finale, but it didn't.
Right. If I'm Bob Saget, I'm pissed.
Right. And I mean, I think Arrested Development is a great example of good writing. And even though they had their ending, mm-hmm. they were able to reach it based upon how many seasons they were given. And then I feel like their real ending, their season finale, their series finale of Arrested Development was the season 3 that actually aired. And I think they have a great series finale because it culminates all their themes and everything, right? The end of the series is Michael basically saying, you know what, I can't deal with you people anymore. I'm going to go off on my own. Now, mm-hmm. when they got their renewal on Netflix, they didn't contradict that at all. They went forward from that and they acknowledged, you know, that was really great storytelling, but in reality, Michael probably would backslide a little bit. And that's what happens. He's given a reason to backslide on the Netflix Arrested Development, as Dan likes to call it.
It's not a real part of the show. It is a separate, a spin-off sort of thing that just has the same or similar characters.
It's an homage to Arrested Development.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And it plays that way because they were able to stay consistent, and even though they were given extra time, they weren't contradicting anything they did before or contradicting the ending they had in their head. Whereas all these other shows, they get to a certain point and they start contradicting.
Yeah.
So let me ask you both, what do you think, which show had the best ending that you've seen?
Justin already mentioned Arrested Development, which was my answer, so he stole my thunder. That's the exact one I was going to name because it was perfect.
Really? The series 3?
Yeah, season 3. Yeah. That's one of my all-time favorite finales. In fact, what's interesting about Arrested Development is they have two finales in that, I don't know if you remember when it was originally ordered, it was only 13 episodes or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I think the last episode was Beef Consomme or Marta Complex in season 1. That was the original story they wrote. And if you watch it just as a 13 episode series, it's really kind of good. It wraps up right on that episode. And then they got more episodes, so they kind of started it up again. There's actually two finales in Arrested Development.
Hmm. Interesting.
But didn't you also say you really like the Seinfeld finale?
I do, and that's a very controversial opinion, but I will defend that finale to the death, and I have for, 15 years now.
So, do it again.
All right. No, just go back in time and listen to my old arguments. I don't need to do it. No.
Where's the doctor when you need him?
The reason I like the Seinfeld finale is because it was just cynical, and it was just mean-spirited, and there was no hugging, no learning, which was the exact motto of the show all along. And what's interesting, what happened with the Seinfeld finale, is if you just watch the episodes and then watch that finale, that's just a callback. It's just like a big orgy of callback references to past episodes. It's like for the true Survivor or Seinfeld nerds. But what happened is, as Seinfeld kind of got towards the last episode, they tried to romanticize it a little bit in the media. And he started doing all these retrospectives on the show, how you'd miss it, how you'd miss all these wonderful characters. Like Entertainment Weekly put out these magazines about, you know, real sympathetic retrospectives of Seinfeld, what a great show it was, how much we're going to miss it. And then right before the finale, they had all this stuff with like making it sad that Seinfeld was leaving. It was the weirdest thing that they tried to build it up as this show that was kind of nice and fun. And so when the finale came, it totally smashed any of this goodwill that people had bought up that they were going to miss these characters. It was just a weird timing, I think, of what happened there. But if you watch it, that finale totally keeps in spirit of every other episode. It's absolutely perfect for, I think, how that show should have ended.
Right, and I think that's fair, because I remember back in the day, I never really watched Seinfeld because of the reasons you said. Like, I just find it far too cynical. Like, even Curb Your Enthusiasm, I'm just like, Larry David, what's your problem? You're standing in line for ice cream. Who cares if the person in front of you is taking 8 hours? I know they're stupid, and it takes them way too long to select ice cream, but you think you'd be used to stupid people by now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so when I watched the finale, because of all the hype you were talking about, because I was young at that point, you know, I was like 19. No, I'm just kidding. I was actually a lot bit younger than that. Mm-hmm. That was a callback to the first article. Yeah, so I watched it, and I was like, I don't get it. This isn't funny. And because I hadn't watched the series, I didn't get it. But I think your analysis is fair. And I think it demonstrates something else that I hadn't really thought of. The media made it so they kind of were trying to make Seinfeld comment on the phenomenon of Seinfeld, it sounds like.
Yeah. Well, they really tried to build it up like it was Cheers, like it was Friends. Like, you'd really miss these characters. Like, we grew up with these characters. We love them. Like, you were not meant to know the Seinfeld characters. At no point in that series were you invited to know these people. So it's just interesting that the way people reacted to that finale, I think they thought they were watching a different show than they really were.
Well, there's no argument that people watch things differently than they actually are. I mean, you know, I argue that all the time. The phenomenon you're talking about, though, is when I look at these finales that we're talking about, you know, we talk about How I Met Your Mother, we talk about Lost, Battlestar Galactica. I think all of these finales, now that you say that, were more commenting on their own show than they were actually a culmination of their own show. So when you look at the Lost finale, it wasn't really about, like, let's have an end to the Lost plot lines we've introduced. It was saying, hey, let's say a final farewell to all these characters. Like, somehow they owe the audience to, like, have all the characters take a bow like it's Broadway, you know, and they all come out. And then Battlestar Galactica was the same way. It was like, you know, we could resolve our plot lines, but why don't we just put them all on a tribal Earth together and just have them all talk about, like, oh, let's start over. And then How I Met Your Mother was the same way. The ending in itself of killing off the mother was like a cynical commentary on their own premise. You know, they couldn't just say, this is our premise, we're going to do it. They had to say, you think that's our premise? No, we're just going to do the traditional sitcom thing.
Yeah. The thing with How I Met Your Mother, I've seen a lot of people confused about the criticism. Like, how could you hate the ending? That was perfect. Like, it's the story itself, I thought, worked great. I don't think I have a problem with them killing the mother and having Ted end up with Robin. It just, they could have done it so less clumsily. Like, it's to the point, if you guys have seen Misery, the movie Misery, where Annie Wilkes goes on a little rant about serial movies back in the day, where even though the ending was right, if the writers cheat to get there, she would get mad. She's like, he didn't get out of the car, they cheated. So that's to me what I feel about How I Met Your Mother. Like, the ending probably was correct, but they really cheated to get there the way they wrote it. They really set it up dishonestly, and that's why I think people are mostly mad at it.
Well, right, and that's what happens when you make the finale a commentary on the rest of the series. It's the same thing with Lost. Like, if they had just made the show Lost about, you know, hey, people getting to know each other on an island, I don't think anyone would have been offended at the ending. But at the end, when we're just supposed to accept, oh, well, they all lived and they died and it doesn't matter what happened on the island ultimately. It was just about them meeting each other. I don't think anyone would have been upset, but you get upset about it because of that. Likewise, when you talk about, you know, in Battlestar, is technology important or not? And you just throw all the technology in the sun to get rid of it. People get pissed because why did I watch all this time about, like, is technology, why did I discuss these questions and care about them? Is technology important or not? I mean, you know, I agree with you about the ending of How I Met Your Mother. I actually wrote a blog post recently, how I would have ended How I Met Your Mother, where I talk about how they could have done their ending and actually had it work by sticking to their theme. And ultimately, the twist I have in that is you spend the whole time thinking it's Ted and telling the story, when ultimately it's Ted and Robin telling the story to explain why Robin and Ted are together, even though she's not the kid's parents. So yeah. It's kind of like them sitting down saying, hey, you know, we know your mom's gone, but we want you to be okay with us being together.
Kids, this is why Aunt Robin slept over last night.
See, that would have been a better name for the series.
Yes.
But
anyway,
Dan, to go back and answer your question, because we we got in a long thing. My favorite finales, I count the Firefly movie Serenity as a finale, because it's the culmination of all the themes and everything of the show and the plot, and it's perfect. I mean, I'm gonna probably be strung up for saying this, but I'm kind of glad the show was canceled because the movie was
made. Shut up! What are you trying to destroy our entire audience?
No, what I mean by that is I would obviously love to see more Firefly, but they would have gone into the whole plotline about the evil Blue Sun Corporation just propping up the Alliance government and everything. But as it stands, it's just that the evil Alliance government is experimenting on humans and trying to perfect them. And just the movie is pure perfection. So the fact that that movie exists is because the show was canceled. That's all I'm saying, is that's the bright side to the show being canceled.
You're saying you'd rather not have any listeners. That's what you're saying. So go ahead.
I'd rather be right than have listeners. Mario is familiar with this with my Survivor writing.
Yes, I'm well aware.
And then I also love the Angel finale, where I do think that show was canceled as well, but Angel was always about every season, like the apocalypse would come up and he would avert it, which how do you always avert the apocalypse, but that's a different thing. And then the end of the show was not like, hey, everything's okay and I saved the day and we're all happy. It was another apocalypse is happening and Angel just says, somebody asks him what they're going to do and he says, well, I guess we just fight on. And that was completely consistent with the show. And then my all-time favorite finale, can you guess it, Dan?
House. Yeah.
Because the later seasons, people, I know they hate them a lot, but every season worked with the theme of the show. It was House trying to figure out, why am I so miserable? Why am I so upset? And then finally, in the end, he realized, it's because I'm not doing the things I want to do. And in the final episode, he said, I'm going to do what I want to do. He fakes his own death so he can get out of being a doctor and spend time with his friend who's dying of cancer. So it's a final farewell to everything he did in the show, you know, being a doctor, his relationship with Wilson. But at the same time, it's him finally culminating what he's been trying to do, and that's figure out how to be happy, and he does that.
I think the best ending ever is Saint Elsewhere, where you find out the entire show is in an autistic kid's snow globe.
That episode took balls to write.
Mind blown.
Isn't that the ultimate ending commentating on a show, though? Because isn't that every show, story, book is just from the mind of an autistic kid?
Oh, it's meta.
No, and also, do you also like the ending of Dallas?
Is that all a dream episode?
Right, so was Bobby autistic as well?
Yes, of course. Because they're all autistic.
That's one where at the end we find out that everyone died and Bobby was banging Robin.
And the ending of Scrubs actually wasn't bad either. The problem was they just did that whole ninth season, which I never watched. But if you watch the eighth season finale, it's, you know, JD, like, moving on from working at the hospital and everything. So that wasn't bad. It was just that they tried to do that spinoff season of a different show, but they tried to transition to it with the characters and everything.
I hate all endings, so go ahead.
What, you hate all endings?
Yeah, I mean, I like the House finale. That was pretty good, but I can't think of one that has made me go, yeah. That works, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I just agree with what Daniel said earlier, that I kind of appreciate the British mentality of get in, get out, and end when you're still strong.
Exactly. I mean, even the British ones that I like, I'm sort of like, that was an episode.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of which, because this kind of takes the British model, because the British model is starting to be replicated on cable, where they have the shorter seasons. I mean, I think we'd be remiss to not mention the Breaking Bad finale.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, if you talk about culmination of themes and everything, so the entire show is essentially about him breaking bad and becoming evil. And he finally becomes evil in the finale, and there's only one thing that can happen to true evil, right? True evil...
They take over the world?
Right, because that works so well for Pinky and the Brain. No, the only thing that can happen to true evil is true evil cannot survive, because it's destructive. And ultimately, he dies at the end, right? So that's the only thing that can happen.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's the perfect finale.
It was good. So now that we've spoiled basically every television show of the past 20 years.
The Sopranos just cuts out. Ultimately, How I Met Your Mother was poorly written, as well as many of these other finales that I've just railed on. But the question is, do we think any writing is good? Find out in Yahoo Answers Answers. And it's just another question. Just another answer I won't be getting. Just another question. Just another answer I won't be getting. First question. 10 points. Is my writing good? So whoever answers this question the best will get 10 points on Yahoo Answers, I guess.
Awesome.
We'll go find the kid and make sure he gives you 10 points. Hi guys, I'm a 17-year-old guy and currently writing my own book. I like to write other people's books. Is my writing good based on your first sentence? No.
No.
Failure.
This is not an excerpt from it, but merely an example of how I write. Just to clarify, the positive scenario created in this example is nothing like the real thing I'm writing. So you're using this to represent your writing then? My story has a lot of violence and death, but here's the positive. Please review it. But I like stories with violence and death. I feel like this is like people, what people expected of the Seinfeld finale, like Mario was saying. Here's a cynical story. Let me give you one with unicorns and rainbows.
Yeah.
All right, exactly. Dan, you want to read his story?
Chris stepped out of the cave, his hair drenched and his clothes soiled with polluted water. He cringed in disgust as the strong scent of mud invaded his nostrils, but he was thankful to make it out alive in one piece. Moments after setting foot outside, he looked up and was astounded by the sudden sun's rays that he hadn't seen in over a week. He sighed heavily as he gazed around the landscape, listening carefully to nature being engulfed by the crashing sounds of a massive waterfall nearby. The last memory Chris regained was when the weather wasn't too promising, unsurprising in a month like December, but the serenity of the blue and cloudless sky suggested a bright day ahead. Chris's eyes widened in amazement when he noticed in a small pool of fresh water by the rocks. Thank fuck.
Aww.
He walked over barefooted and knelt down, scooping water with his hands and pouring it all over himself in appreciation. Chunks of mud and dust caught in his hair washed away, and he began to slurp the remaining water on his palms.
So that should be enough. Someone please review my style critically and tell me if there's anything wrong with it. T.Y. period. I think so you might have forgot the C and the B at the end there.
Oh, I thought his name was Ty.
Oh, that was a TCBY joke. Okay, he biased me. This is an example of confirmation bias, because when he says my story has a lot of violence and death, I picture him in a cave in the Hunger Games arena, and he's coming out and cleaning himself after waking up and protecting himself in the cave at night.
I think this kid really has a future in writing dialogue.
Thank fuck.
Is really what I think. That thank fuck just perfectly matched the rest of the prose. Yeah.
I have to give you credit, Daniel. When you read it, it was like I was there. The thank fuck part.
Yeah, I know. I really channeled it.
How do you thank fuck?
Has anybody ever said that?
I've never said it. Not in my real life.
Did you ever say it when you were in the Hunger Games arena?
Maybe. Too busy, you know, being hungry.
Yeah, hungering and gaming. But here's the thing. This would be my critique of it, is we'll go back to that same sentence. Let's go to earlier in that sentence. Chris's eyes widen in amazement. That's redundant. Either say his eyes widened or like he looked on in amazement. Like showing what happens to him should communicate the amazement. Like, it seems like he hasn't decided if he wants to show or tell.
Right.
I think the thank fuck shows the amazement.
Well, no, you're right too, and I mean, this is one of the differences between Mario's writing style and mine, is I'm much more descriptive, which is kind of ironic, because I don't think I'm that descriptive at all. But Mario focuses, if you read his, he wrote these great things, what, about 10 years ago, Mario?
It was about 10.
The Survivor All-Star stories.
Yeah, I basically tried to predict what an Survivor All-Star season would look like. So I tried to make it as realistic as if you were reading it as possible.
Right. So they're huge novels, basically, right? If you go read them, he does each episode. But, I mean, each episode is like, I don't know, like 20 pages or something.
Some of them are like 80 pages each.
Right. And basically everything is communicated about what the characters are thinking and feeling through their actions in the dialogue. It never says like, Greg Buist was feeling frisky, so he built a coconut phone. It was just like, you know, Greg Buist ran off into the jungle and frolicked there and put things together and created this thing that no one understood. And obviously I'm hacking up what you're saying, what you wrote, but
yeah.
You get the point
I'm
making.
Yeah, I'd show him doing it.
Right, he would show him, and that would communicate how he was feeling and where he was at in the game and where his head was at and why he was doing with his alliance. He never was like, he was amazed, so he said, thank fuck. He would just be like, Chris noticed the small pool of water by the rocks. Thank fuck. And you'd be like, oh, okay, based upon my knowledge of the character, that's why he's acting.
Uh-huh.
Now, this guy has a little more description than you have.
Yeah, it's just different style. I mean, you can do lots of different ways in writing, so it really doesn't make it. I mean, to me, it's just personal preference.
Right.
Right. I think my main critique would be right along the lines of what Justin said, which is that, I mean, in terms of writing, it's not terrible. He has a place to start. But there's a lot of redundancy in terms of the types of descriptors he uses. So go through, clean it out, make sure you're saying things once and in the appropriate way, not multiple times and over the top.
Right. So there seems to be a little bit of he wants to sound impressive, so he's trying to pretty it up. I would say just write what you want to say rather than trying to sound impressive.
Mm-hmm. I would just say my pet peeve is really long sentences with really long words that just sounds like someone trying to impress a writing teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't read like you would read a book. And there's one in here in particular, the last memory Chris regained was when the weather wasn't too promising. Unsurprising in a month like December, but the serenity of the blue and cloudless sky suggested a bright day ahead. I mean, that's not how people talk. So yeah. I just try to do shorter sentences. That's just a kind of a pet peeve of mine.
Right, and to me that came across very expository, like he was trying to establish it was December. Like he couldn't just be like, it was December. He had to like try and throw that in there under the radar.
Yeah, and again, it's just like someone trying to impress a writing teacher, which is why I think writing for like classes and teachers is different than writing for an audience sometimes.
Oh, and that's certainly true, and that's one of the biggest problems with teaching writing because it's non-objective. You know, I studied writing at Ithaca is, and you know, actually Mario helped me in one of the classes. I had a sports writing class where I wrote an essay about Survivor as sport, which I thought was pretty good, and I quoted Mario about it. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I think I only got a B in that class because I was writing for the teacher. I wasn't writing for, and I personally wasn't writing for the teacher, but to get a good grade, I would have had to write for the teacher. But because people see writing skills as non-objective,
mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to actually find people who teach you how to write. Usually it's just, hey, read this and then write about it and I'll tell you whether I liked your writing or not.
Yeah. So much of writing is writing for your audience. It just really changes depending on who you're writing for. And I noticed that in particular, doing so much writing for me, for the Survivor world, I know exactly what Survivor fans want to hear. But if I send my essays or articles to like an editor or an English teacher, they just hate my stuff because it's not written like scholastically. It's just different.
So basically what you're saying is you're the BuzzFeed of Survivor writers.
All I'm saying is thank fuck for that.
Next question. Is Slumdog Millionaire a perfect film that shows the reality about India?
Ask to three guys who do not know the reality of India.
Well, before we go into his description,
I don't know.
This goes back to what we were saying earlier. Why do you want to see the reality of India? Just if you want to, on TV or in the movies, if you want to, just go to India, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right.
Although I don't know why you'd want to.
Just watch Slumdog Millionaire.
So the description this person has is, one kid wants to sign an autograph from, I don't know how you sign an autograph from, I think you mean for, or he wants to get an autograph from, Amitabh Bachchan, and he goes through a toilet pit with crap all over his body, LOL.
Isn't that Train Spotting?
It's by the same director, right?
Yeah. I don't know, like, again, have we been to India? Has anybody here been to India?
No.
How will we know what the reality of India is? I have no idea.
Yeah, so before Justin jumps in with some racist remark about my girlfriend being Pakistani, I will say that I've watched a lot of Bollywood films, too many Bollywood films. And in terms of, quote, the reality of India, there's a lot of reality to India. There are poor areas, there are rich areas, there are urban places, there are rural places. So I reject the premise of the question. There isn't one reality about India.
Well, yeah, is there one reality about anywhere? Not really.
Exactly. And not to mean, before also Justin jumps down my throat about, you know, context and objective reality. I'm not saying that there's not an objective reality. I'm saying that there are many, India's a big place, billion plus people, lots of stuff going on. Part of Slumdog Millionaire is correct. Part of it's probably not. Part of the Bollywood movies are correct. Part of them probably aren't, especially the singing, dancing part.
That's what I was going to say. You think I care about objective reality right now. I just want to know that whenever they get to where they actually have to solve a problem in India, does everyone just break into a large song and dance number and everything is solved?
Yeah. You know, basically the plot of every Bollywood movie is girl loves guy, guy loves girl, but they can't love each other, so they get married to other people and then eventually come find each other.
Isn't that the plot to Slumdog Millionaire?
Yeah. That's the plot of every Bollywood movie. I'm trying to tell you, there is not a single plot I've ever seen that is not that.
Maybe How I Met Your Mother was actually a Bollywood movie.
That would actually explain, if they had sung a dance, I think people would have taken the ending better.
And also would have been a 6-hour season finale.
That was my critique of Slumdog Millionaire, right? Like, I really enjoyed, the first 3/4 of that movie. So the first 3/4 of the movie are the guy is on Indian Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which means who wants to have $5. And every time he has to answer a question, it shows him remembering something that happened in his life that helped him answer the question. And that's great use of narrative and plot construct. That's just unbelievably creative and unbelievably interesting. But then it gets to the end and somehow the who wants to have $5 isn't important anymore. He runs out to find the girl. He gets into a fight and then he's like, all our problems don't matter. We're in love. Love will save us. And then they dance. And I was just like, what happened to the movie I was watching?
Maybe that's the reality of India.
I completely agree with you for once in my life, Justin. That movie, sitting in the theater crying for the first 3/4 of the movie, and then the last quarter I was like, what the fuck, what just happened?
Exactly.
So, I still can't get over this. Sorry.
Yeah, I almost wanted to leave. I was so pissed off about where the movie went.
I still can't get over the fact that we're supposed to know the reality of India. Yeah, three white guys from the US.
Hey, I'm what? Half Mexican from the US.
I'm sorry. I mean, the extent of what I know about India is from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. I know that they box and wear turbans and can float.
And they worship cows.
Apparently, I don't know.
And yes, I watched that sitcom Outsourced, and they have paint day where they run around and throw paint at each other.
Mm-hmm. Their McDonald's don't serve beef, so they have the Maharaja Mac,
yes,
which is a chicken sandwich.
I'm glad all our listeners tuning in to learn about India are learning these facts.
Also,
this is exactly the show they'd want to learn from.
Curry and oil.
It's true.
We're just naming
dots,
things now.
Dots, not feathers, Indians. Dots, not feathers.
That's where the world engine was on the opposite side of the world in Man of Steel.
I think Indiana Jones might have been there at one point.
See, we know a lot about the reality of India.
Body odor.
Exactly.
Next question. I'm driving from Mississippi to California, cool places to stop. Well, maybe a library to learn some grammar. So I'm in the Air Force, and I just found out my next base is in Northern California. So the government will pay for me to drive from Mississippi to California. All right, I'm just going to stop here. You know, they can't just say, take a plane, we'll pay for the ticket. They're going to pay for him to drive across the entire country.
Air Force is great.
It's efficient.
You would, especially because he's in the Air Force, they would want him to fly, right?
Yeah. No, we don't trust planes.
John Madden is now in charge of the Air Force. And I was wondering about some cool places to stop along the way. Any suggestions appreciated, and it's all right if they are a little out of the way. Winky face. Thanks! Exclamation point. I feel like he's flirting with all of Yahoo Answers.
Yeah, I don't think I have to ask or tell in this scenario.
Yeah, so basically, which motel would he like us to meet him at?
Yeah, they say things about the Air Force. So, actually, Justin, you and I have both done a drive like this from the East Coast to the West. Did you find anything interesting along the way?
Correct. I drove from South Carolina to L.A. when I did it. And I actually wish I had stopped more. I was, for some reason, when I didn't have a job and I had more money, had decided I was going to do it as quickly as possible, which, in hindsight, I feel really stupid for. I would say you're in Mississippi, don't stop in Mississippi. I think that was the worst place I drove through. Like, what's the big city in Mississippi that I drove through? I don't remember.
Exactly.
But I remember thinking, this is the worst city I've ever seen. Like, this is worse than Atlanta. Worse than Charlotte, even. I mean, I know Charlotte's up and coming as a city, but, like, are you kidding me? It's not, it doesn't look very city-like, and it's not very nice.
Yeah, Mississippi is just a lot of people missing their legs sitting on their porch. That's really all of Mississippi.
That's the reality of Mississippi.
So you're telling me the prison in The Walking Dead wasn't actually in Georgia. It was in Mississippi because Herschel lost his leg.
Yeah, exactly.
So I would say skip that. I would also say...
Skip Mississippi.
Skip Amarillo, Texas, because I stopped there for a couple
nights. No! First of all, you butchered the name, but...
Amarillo?
Is this the weekly digestion? No, it's Amarillo.
What's Amarillo? Amarillo. Okay, maybe I stopped on the outskirts because I was like right next to a Walmart and like a highway, and there was like nobody there except like random people wandering. I mean, it was like where the zombie apocalypse was going to start or be filmed.
That was going to be my one and only place you must stop on your trek across the country is Amarillo, Texas.
No,
at the Walmart.
At the Walmart.
At the Walmart in Amarillo. No, Amarillo has a fantastic place called the Big Texan. The Big Texan is the place that invented the steak eating challenge.
Oh, they're not the ones who invented the cliche that everything's bigger in Texas?
No, they just played the marketing up on that. And they have a giant cow there that's enormous. Anyway, so if you eat the 72-ounce steak, potato, vegetables, and roll in 2 hours, it's free.
So correct. More evidence not to start in Armadillo, Texas.
They're also a microbrew and a hotel and a gift shop. And if you're staying somewhere other than their hotel, they will send a limo to pick you up.
So they're a tourist trap.
Yes, it is the greatest tourist trap I've ever seen in my life. I'm still there.
Incorrect. The greatest tourist trap is the place you should stop on your way across the country. Las Vegas, Nevada.
Yes.
How original.
It doesn't have to be original. All I know is some people were like, hey, there's nothing here. Why don't we just fucking put a town and make people gamble and let it so they can do whatever they want?
What next? People should drive on Route 66?
There's no Route 66. Come on.
It's a myth.
Oh, I'm glad you confirmed that for me, Mario, because even in California, I see signs that are like, historic Route 66, and I'm like, why does it seem like it's all over the place?
Well, it was a series of roads they connected, and then it was decommissioned, so a lot of the roads don't even exist anymore. It just winds, one big freeway.
It winds from Chicago to LA.
I happen to live right on Route 66, so I know a lot about this.
Well, yeah, I would just say Las Vegas. And then, you know, if you haven't done stuff like the Grand Canyon, it's probably worth doing stuff like that, too.
That's funny. When I was moving back from L.A. to Austin, Texas, the Grand Canyon was closed because of the government shutdown.
What?
Wow.
Did they put a tarp on top of it?
Well, we tried to drive the park, the national park, and, like, miles away, they, like, had a gated thing that said, park is closed due to government shutdown.
You were there shorter than Chevy Chase was.
Yes, it was awesome because I hate nature. But yeah, skip the Grand Canyon. It's a big hole in the ground.
You're missing a fun little tourist trap right between Texas and the Grand Canyon. There is Roswell, New Mexico. There is no place like that in the country. It's just all kitschy and tourist trappy.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I mean, I stopped in Albuquerque, and this was but early Walter White era, so it wasn't that big, but now it's huge. Mm-hmm. Now there's a whole Breaking Bad tourist industry.
Is there?
Yeah, you can take tours of where everything in Breaking Bad happened, and there's a lot that, like, the hot dog stand where they used to eat is constantly packed, like you can't get near the place.
Well, there you go, Drew. If you wanted to know where to go when you're coming out to California, there you go. Stop in Albuquerque, because I know you're a big Breaking Bad fan. So stop in Albuquerque, go to the hot dog stand, and then when you come out here, go to El Pollo Loco, which is surely the basis of Los Pollos Hermanos.
Yes.
Next question. If you had to pick one of these Disney boy names to use on a baby, which would it be and why? By the way, I love the fact that this says on a baby, because it seems like...
You're going to inflict it on him.
That's exactly what it seems like they're doing. Yes.
So I cast Simba.
So this
it's
is now
super effective.
This is now Kingdom Hearts.
So let's hear this. Let's,
yeah, let's hear the name. Which name would you like your child to be beat up while having?
Abu, Aladdin, Gaston, Iago, Jafar, Nemo, Pluto, Simba, Tarzan, Timon, and Winnie.
Which Winnie, of course.
Which is not like the other.
I'm just going to name him Pooh.
Oh, he'd be Pooh, all right.
Mm-hmm.
First name Winnie, middle name Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
I think that out of this list, I would pick Pluto just to see. It would be a test to see if any kids over his life made fun of him for not being a planet anymore.
The one name on this list that actually stands out is Iago. Wasn't Iago a Shakespearean name?
Right.
Yeah, so Iago wins by default.
What about Gaston? That's not too bad, right?
Yeah, but it's French. And I can't, I just, no. Absolutely not.
I think a little kid named...
Do you want your kid to grow up to be gay? I don't understand.
Well, you got Winnie on there. I think a kid named Tarzan would be pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I mean, Tarzan is the nickname weird old people on Survivor give to themselves.
Imagine a poor kid named Tarzan when they like have rope climbing class in gym and stuff like that. It's like, come on, Tarzan, show us how to do it. What if the kid's like a little spaz? Then you just ruin his life.
Or if he was like chubby, that'd be terrible. Tarzan can't do the monkey bars. The irony.
Well, what if they go to the zoo for a field trip? Would someone try to throw him in with the monkeys? And then when they got in trouble, they'd be like, but it's his family.
We're putting him back to nature.
I will tell you, if the kid was chubby and his name was Winnie, like Winnie the Pooh, it would be really funny.
The little red shirt on him that doesn't fit.
No pants. He looks like a little pervert. Red shirt. A little fat pervert.
That's great.
I think there are some names omitted from this list, aren't there?
Yeah. Of course, there's Marlin, who's Nemo's father.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one. Let's see.
Mowgli?
Mowgli? That's right. I was trying to think of that one. I could not think of that one. Yeah. Or Mustafa?
Mufasa, you mean?
Oh, yeah, that one. Mufasa?
Rafiki?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if Shark Boy and Lava Girl were Disney, but those would be awesome names, cool too.
There already is a Shark Boy. He's a professional wrestler.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Thank fuck for that.
Pumbaa. If you have Timon on the list, you have to have Pumbaa.
Right. What's the name of the hunchback? Quasimodo.
Yeah.
And that doubles as a reference to a historic novel, classic novel.
Indeed. I would just call him Hunchback, though. I don't.
Flotsam and Jetsam.
Chippendale Rescue Rangers.
You could go Cars and go Lightning McQueen. That would be an awesome name for a little kid.
Finn McMissile. Sir Miles Axelrod.
See, people like Cars.
I love Cars.
But now that Star Wars is owned by Disney, you have that entire universe.
Oh, here we go.
So, you know, Jabba is right on the top of that list.
Yeah, that kid better not be fat.
There's got to be a kid out there named Boba Fett. There has to be.
There has to be, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, I would not name my kid any of these things.
No, these are terrible, stupid names, and you're a horrible parent for even thinking about it.
Right.
Well, we already know they're a horrible parent. They're asking for advice on Yahoo Answers.
Also, if you're going to do something like this on the internet, why not auction it off on, like, eBay? You name our son after a Disney character. Go. See how much money you can raise.
Yeah, but then
do you remember in the early 90s when someone did this? Not with Disney names, but with just corporate sponsorship. And I believe it was Xerox won it.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. They have a little kid named Xerox running around.
So he'll play in the NFL one day, right?
Yeah. Just tell people he's Greek.
Oh, I was going to say, like, Plaxico Burress. Just tell people he's black.
Just tell people he's black, Justin?
Yeah. I don't see color, Dan.
Yeah, we know that's not true whatsoever.
Next question. What's something you've been through that most people will probably never go through?
Well, from the looks of the writing, elementary school. He's missing some commas.
Yeah, well, then for me, it would be a rigorous
an
education. An apostrophe.
So this is one of the smarter questions I think we've ever had on here.
That's why I picked it, because I saw it and it was like a mirage. I was like, is that real? And it was.
It's good. Well done, Justin. Good find.
Are we doing serious answers, or are we just talking crap about the guy who wrote it?
Oh, we're doing all of it.
Okay. I have a serious answer about this one, that I've been through a volcano explosion, and nobody can say that.
Were those volcano movies based on you with Pierce Brosnan and the other one with Tommy Lee Jones?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. It was all based on reality. But yes, I was in Spokane, Washington in 1980. I was 6 years old, and Mount St. Helens blew up. So I know full well what it looks like when your city is covered with volcanic ash for 2 months. And that is something, one of my strongest memories of my childhood, that where everybody had to wear these masks to protect your lungs from all the ash and stuff. And they canceled school and you couldn't drive cars because all the ash would get into the intake and it would ruin your car. So yeah, I've been through a volcano explosion and the aftermath. And I don't think most people can say that.
Yeah, I don't think most people can say they had a volcano day at school.
Yeah, we had volcano month. They closed down the whole city.
Usually that's when you put baking soda in like something and it explodes.
Exactly.
When it was exploding, did you duck and cover under your desk?
Like no, we were all the way across the state. We just got the fallout on the other side of the state. We didn't see the lava or anything.
Mm. Not like Pompeii.
It was a lot like Pompeii.
It's funny. You know the thing I've been through that no one else has been through, who will ever go through, is my birth.
<That's> the, you've passed through your mother's vaginal cavity. Well done.
Exactly.
Because you're an only child.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the literal answer to this question, right? My life is what I've been through that most people will never go through.
That's deep.
But you have something else, right, Justin? You have something that you've been through.
Do you care to share what you're thinking?
No, absolutely not. I'd rather make you guess it about your own life.
I can't, because actually I was thinking about this question, and the reason I said life is I can't think of, like, maybe I just, you know, have had too many concussions and need to retire like Wes Welker or Taylor Twellman. But I can't think of like one large thing. And that made me think about like the answer to the question, right? What's something you've been through that most people will never go through? So if you look at the question, one, the word most, I mean, first off, I'm one of 300 million in America, and then I'm from the Northeast, and now I'm living in California. So I'm a small subsection of people to begin with. And then if you look at all the things I've been in my life, so I'm sure there's a lot of little events I could say. And the other thing is the word through implies some sort of a ordeal they want to know about. So it's not like, what's one really awesome happy day with unicorns you've experienced? It's like, tell us about a Seinfeld cynical experience you've been through. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're like, fucking philosophy major, Justin?
Minor, thank you.
Yes.
I bet that gets used all the time on your job application.
No. Well, I'm pretty sure people just look at my resume now and they just throw them away. Like,
on a toilet paper.
I've gotten like two interviews, and the two things they prefaced it with were, one were like, he really likes that you're interested in music. And the other one was like, oh, he really likes that you're interested in soccer. So it was like the little section at the bottom that I put of my interests are the only thing that have actually garnered interest for my resume.
We've never met anyone who actually likes soccer.
So, Dan, what are you trying to get me to guess?
Oh, no. I mean, there's been a couple of things. The one I wanted you to rail about was that you worked both at the Ayn Rand Institute and for the Atlas Shrugged movie.
Oh, I was
which
gonna...
basically no one will bridge that gap except for you.
Well, that's true. And I think I'm pretty much the only one with a brain who worked on the Atlas Shrugged movie.
There is that.
But no, I mean, yeah, that's probably true. No, it's not probably true. It is true. I'm the only one who's worked both at the Ayn Rand Institute and on the movie and seen firsthand the similarities between both. I know that's sort of blasphemy to say, but, you know, the things that caused the movie to fail actually aren't limited to the movie. They come from a much deeper-seated thing in this other organization, which, like I said, most of them probably wouldn't want to admit. And maybe that's why I seem crazy screaming on the internet being like, all of you are stupid, shut up, because I've been through this.
That's true. Although I think even if you hadn't been to that, you'd still be screaming on the internet that everyone is stupid.
Well, that's true. But to ground it in, you know, more movie-based stuff about, you know, for our TalkBacker audience, which is the site that, you know, we post on now, you know, Finn was gracious enough to put our podcast up, so I thank him for that. Working on the movie really showed me a lot about firsthand how movies are made, and there are two things I really learned about it. The importance of visual storytelling. So, you know, in the first question we were talking about, you know, this guy was telling, he wasn't showing. It's the same sense in movies. Like, I picked up expository dialogue before I worked on the movies. I pick it up so much more now. Like, I see when writers in television, especially in one-hour-long dramas or half-an-hour-long sitcoms, are just throwing in expository dialogue because they don't have the time to establish it visually. And yeah. I see it when directors are doing it in movies, where they just put a line in, or screenwriters are doing it in movies, a line of dialogue, rather than establishing it visually. So that's a major thing that's important, is thinking, what am I trying to say? How do I concretize that in a visual symbol? And how do I establish that either with camera angles, effects in editing, or actual set dressing, or costuming, or hair and makeup, all this other stuff. And then the other thing I learned is, it's so important to have a producer who is solely creatively focused. And what I mean by that is, when you look at the Atlas Shrugged movies, their major failing is that the people involved in it are lawyers and businessmen and software people. None of them are a creative mind. So if you don't have that, you know, whereas you look at something like Man of Steel or the Dark Knight trilogy, those are all run by a creative person, right? Nolan with Dark Knight trilogy and Snyder with Man of Steel. That's why they're able to be so successful, whereas the Atlas Shrugged movie failed where it didn't have a creative mind in charge. So those would be the two major things I learned from the experience I've been through that no one else has. Maybe not quite as exciting as a volcano.
Thank you, Grandpa Justin. That was very informative.
Well, I'm glad I could be informative. And something that most people will never go through is our game, Crush, Kill, Destroy. So let's introduce Mario to it, shall we?
Wait, what?
Destroy! Crush! Kill! Destroy! Crush! Kill! Destroy! Crush! Kill!
So Mario, this is actually the second ever edition of the game Crush, Kill, Destroy. And this is a game, it's our version of Fuck, Marry, Kill, because nerdcore rapper Tribe One wrote a song called Crush, Kill, Destroy, and I was like, oh wow, that'd make a really great intro. How do I force a game into this? So basically it is, we give you three characters or famous people, and you decide which one you want to crush, which you want to kill, and which you want to destroy.
Now, aren't all three of those things the same thing?
No, you can say them however you want. That's where the creativity comes in, right?
Okay, so either one, we're going to do horrible things to all three people just in creative ways.
Not necessarily, so...
How do you not kill someone horribly?
It could be merciful.
I find a fault in your premise.
It could be Carrot Top.
Let me explain with the example we did before. So previously we did the Michelle edition, and it was Michelle Rodriguez, Michelle Kwan, and Michelle Obama. So as you can guess, most of us were violent towards Michelle Obama.
Naturally.
With the crush, Dan said he wanted to crush on Michelle Rodriguez because the only reason we had her on in that is because that was the week she came out of the closet officially, because we all knew she was gay before. And then for, like, destroy for Michelle Kwan, I talked about destroying her knee because she's a figure skater. So it's about being creative with what you're doing.
Do you want to know the weirdest coincidence in the world? Is that I would absolutely be fully on board with crushing, killing, and destroying Michelle Kwan because I've had a bad experience with her in real life. This is totally off the cuff. I had no idea you were going to do this. Michelle Kwan, her parents own a restaurant in Torrance, California. I forget the name of it. It's a Chinese restaurant.
Wait, there's Asians who own a Chinese restaurant in Torrance? No way.
Yeah, exactly. It's right. I forget the street it's on. We've been there a couple times. And I will tell you, I got food poisoning at that place twice. And so
it's authentic Chinese then.
It's totally authentic to the point that I will never eat at a Michelle Kwan owned restaurant again. That she should die like the dog that she is. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean she's a fucking horrible person and they make horrible food and don't ever eat there.
So you want her to die like a dog so then they'll serve her at the restaurants?
Only if they cook it through first.
Is the restaurant called My Daughter So Successful You Get Out Now?
Yes. No, it's called You're Gonna Be Shitting This Out in Half an Hour because it's not cooked. Sorry, so let's go back to your nice game. I'm sorry to drag down your game with my hatred.
No, that was actually pretty spot on for the game. So, for this week's Crush, Kill, Destroy, we're gonna be doing H. John Benjamin characters. He's a famous voice actor who has two huge roles in animation right now and then one kind of small one. And the three are Bob Belcher from Bob's Burgers, Sterling Archer from Archer, and Carl from Family Guy. So who wants to go first?
Oh, me, please me.
Go ahead, Dan.
So I didn't even know who Carl from Family Guy was until I asked you about it. But he's the clerk at the 7-Eleven in Family Guy.
Right, and he's Yoda. He was Yoda in the Star Wars editions.
Yeah, I would kill him because he's useless. Never has that character played any significant role on Family Guy. Didn't even know who he was. Completely pointless character. Kill. Gone from the show. That's a straightforward one for me. The other two, harder. Much harder. I think I would have to crush some vegetables and meat with Bob Belcher from Bob's Burgers. Because I would like him to cook me a Bob's Burger. The only thing I found enticing about that show was that he owned his own hamburger joint. The rest of the show I think is terrible. Yep, I said it.
I love
Bob Burgers. And I'm an animation lover. I love animation, but that show, I just, every time I watch 5 minutes of an episode, I'm bored out of my mind.
It's so funny.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
So that would leave destroying Sterling Archer?
Yeah, but I think I would have to help Sterling Archer destroy his mother.
Oh.
To get out from underneath the oppressive matriarchy that he experiences.
So
is this
some sort of Arrested Development sympathy? Because the mother is voiced by the woman who played the mother who keeps Michael in Arrested Development.
Yeah, Julie Walter, is that her name? I think something like that. Yeah, she's hysterical, by the way, on that show. Jessica Walter, thank you. But nonetheless, I feel for Sterling. I think he's overly oppressed by his mother, and she should be destroyed.
Mario, do you have an answer to this question?
I don't actually know who any of these people are. I don't watch as much TV as you guys do. I would just like to follow up that Michelle Kwan should be crushed, destroyed, and killed. And I looked up her family's restaurant. It's called the Golden Pheasant in Torrance. So if I could put in a plug for people not to eat there ever, that's my plug. So Michelle Kwan, you're going down. You've been asking for it.
So you're killing Michelle Kwan. You're destroying her family business.
Yes. I'm crushing their spirit. I want to crush their dreams.
So you're crushing the spirits of the Kwans by killing their dreams by destroying their restaurant.
Pretty much. I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way. I just want them all to go down horribly.
You don't mean it in a
bad
way.
I think Mario just incited World War III with China.
Yes.
Is Michelle Kwan, is she even Chinese-American or is she Korean-American?
I don't see color, Justin. I don't know.
That so reminds me of Community, where Chang goes, I feel Korean.
Oh, yeah, that was really funny. All right, so my answers. Ready?
Can't wait.
So I would destroy Carl from Family Guy and destroy his life because it's already destroyed because he's a convenience store clerk who is obsessed with Star Wars. And then, you're not a convenience store clerk. It's okay.
It's true.
Then I would crush Bob's hopes and dreams, because that's what happens every week in Bob's Burgers anyway, so he's learned how to deal with it by now. So he'd be like, oh, thanks. And then I would kill Sterling Archer, because ISIS would just find a way to bring him back anyway. Plus, I would get satisfaction, because I don't really get that show. Like, I tried watching it, and I was like, so the premise of the show is he's stupid, but he's not really stupid?
He's a savant.
So the premise of the show is he's an idiot savant.
Yeah, he's a spy idiot savant.
So then, yes, he would definitely somehow get killed and then not, or get unkilled or brought back to life. They would, maybe they would use Tribble Blood to bring him out, back to life and cure all death without noting the fact that they cured death.
It's true.
That was a reference to Star Trek Into Darkness, in case anyone didn't pick it up.
Thanks.
All right. So, that brings us to the end of our journey into the Midside this week. And as always, I want to know, what did we learn today? Dan?
Well, I learned about the concept of geek blackface. And I'm going to get into this. I'm going to start demanding that all character types are portrayed only by the real-life versions of themselves. So, for instance, those dragons on Game of Thrones can no longer be CGI. That's dragon blackface. They need to be portrayed by real dragons.
That's not an accurate portrayal of dragons either. Do all dragons breathe fire? That is super impressive to the dragons that are not capable of breathing fire.
And you think dragons would go to Burning Man because they like fire.
Bringing it around. Thank you. So that's what I'm going to start crusading. This will be my issue.
Mario, what did you learn today?
You know, this is actually a very valuable tool because I am a writer. So I like to pick up tips from writing. So when I'm writing my own stories, I think of new ideas. But, you know, a lot of problems in writing can be solved when the protagonist turns to the camera and says, thank fuck. So that's really what I learned. That's kind of your out in any scene. If you drop that phrase, you will know that the scene's about to become magical. So thank fuck is now my new writer's tool of choice.
All right. And I learned that I'm just glad this podcast is over, because it's wasting all my time. Thank fuck. You're wasting all my time. You're wasting all my time. You're wasting